Welcome to our radio companion program for KTOO 360 TV's series, ANCSA at 50, The Journey Continues. I'm Rhonda McBride. Every Thursday night at 8, leading up to the anniversary of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act on December 18th, we bring you an ANCSA flashback through films and videos from the past. And when you dig into the archives, you can find some curious things. And we're not sure that this week's program ever aired. In fact, we don't even know what the title of it was, so we have given it a name. 10 Years of ANCSA, Frank Berry Looks Back. Frank Berry was head of the Alaska Native Foundation, an organization founded in 1968 with funding from the Ford Foundation, its mission to help plan for the settlement once it was achieved. It also prepared research papers and the video that we have included in this ANCSA at 50 film series. After financial struggles, the foundation folded sometime in the mid-80s, and the video wound up in the archives of the Alaska Moving Image Preservation Association.
How do you do? My name is Frank Berry. I'm president of the Alaska Native Foundation. During this program, we're going to be talking about the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, which is more commonly referred to as ANCSA. How did it happen? What are its effects? What are its problems? And what will happen tomorrow?
Frank Berry's video is sort of a highlights reel of the 1981 Alaska Federation of Natives Convention, which marked the 10th anniversary of the Claims Act, a decade after regional and village corporations were formed to manage 44 million acres of land and $1 billion cash settlement. Berry, from behind his desk in his office, comments on the speakers almost like he was hosting a talk show. And while we see this sort of thing a lot today through social media and video blogs, it seemed ahead of its time. And some of the speeches that he culled from some of the government leaders who addressed the convention give you a good read on the impacts of ANCSA at the 10-year mark, a time when Native corporations were emerging from years of struggle and beginning to find their way. I have invited two longtime Alaska Native journalists to give us some context for Berry's video. Jacqueline Estes, a national correspondent for Indian Country Today, and Nellie Moore, one of the pioneers of Native broadcasting. Both Jacqueline and Nellie have covered numerous AFN conventions and have spent a lot of their careers trying to help people understand the implications of the Claims Act. So, Jacqueline, I want to start with you. Can you tell us what your impressions are of Frank Berry's program?
Well, I think some of what was in the film is it's information that we've seen or heard about before, but what we didn't have were the insights that Frank Berry was able to add, and those were interesting. And it was really fun to hear some of the voices of people. Governor Hammond, he was so well-spoken and almost poetic, even in what you would think of as kind of an everyday speech. And then it was just fun and interesting to see Don Young when he was much younger and that sort of thing. So I enjoyed watching it.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and play Governor Hammond since you mentioned him. And yes, it is truly a Hammond-esque kind of speech. Let's listen.
With the passage of that act, of course, there came a dramatic change in the United States government's policy towards Native people. Congress determined that the federal government would no longer patronize Native citizens through establishment of reservations, wards, or trusteeships. Such systems started in the early days of colonial expansion, presumed that government knew better how to manage Native affairs than did the Natives themselves. Since those early days, government, of course, has included almost everyone in that presumption. And perhaps it took such increased governmental invasion into all our lives to sensitize sufficient numbers of Americans to the longer-term and more extreme patronizing governmental manipulation of our original Americans, and thus provide more fertile ground for the advancement of the Claims Act. At any rate, with the 1-2 punch of Alaska's Constitution, providing first all with equal rights and obligations, and then the Claims Act, providing added wherewithal to exercise those rights and meet those obligations, racism in Alaska should have been delivered a crippling, if not a knockout blow.
So, Nellie, what were your reactions in hearing Jay Hammond?
Oh, it just brought back a lot of memories. His voice, like you said, the poetic nature of his talking. And he always could make a point. You didn't walk away not knowing what he meant. I loved hearing it.
Well, one of the photographs I love, I cherish, is a picture that you posted on your own Facebook page of you interviewing Jay Hammond. And it must have been in Kotzebue because he's wearing kind of a vintage 70s suit with big lapels, yeah, polyester, and you are wearing overalls.
Yeah. That was in the old Alaska Airlines hangar that was there before they built the new ugly one.
So you have a connection with Jay Hammond.
Well, you know, I had interviewed him many times in the different jobs that I had. And, you know, we had the funniest talk because I think it was the first time I met him. I asked him about Bella.
And for those people who don't know, Bella was his wife. She passed on a couple of years ago.
Yes. He told me their first date was Bella made him carry her mom's birthday cake to their house, and it was a really rough trail. He was jumping over logs or whatever, and it was hysterical because he was so worried about messing up the cake, making Bella mad.
And I think he dropped it, as the story goes. I really miss him when I see that video, because I really think in his heart of hearts that he cared so much about Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
Bella was an Alaska native from the Bristol Bay region, and I think that gave him a lot of sympathy for Native causes and the sense that Natives were being interfered with in trying to live a good life.
I think he could see the possibilities.
That was what his governance was all about.
I think he was really an unusual and interesting person. You know, he wrote poetry in addition to giving speeches that sounded poetic. And he had a profound effect on the history of Alaska, I think, in that he was one of the group of people who created the Alaska Permanent Fund and then the Alaska Permanent Fund dividend. And not long after, Alaskans wanted to do away with the state income tax, which he fought, but he didn't succeed. And what he predicted was that the state would eventually run out of oil money and would have no sources of revenue and would run into a fiscal crisis. And most of what he said is true.
Well, he was an idea guy, and the permanent fund was an idea that was untried, untested, and so was the Claims Act. It was an economic experiment. And in fact, I'm going to play this one cut from Lloyd Meads, who talks about that. He was actually reading a speech for Scoop Jackson, Senator Scoop Jackson, who couldn't be there. And he was, of course, one of the movers and shakers that got the legislation crafted and passed. And here's what Lloyd Meads had to say about ANCSA being the great experiment.
When the Congress adopted the Claims Act in 1971, it set in motion a bold, radical, and totally untested experiment in government, in social ordering, and in private enterprise.
So that was Lloyd Meads talking about ANCSA in lofty terms. And in contrast to that, and of course, Jay Hammond's flowery speech, we have Don Young. Let's listen to what he has to say about ANCSA.
You've done one hell of a job. You've done what most of the people thought you could never do. If you'll ever study that act, it was full of pitfalls. It was meant to fail. But you fooled them. You've made yourself into a viable economic force within the state of Alaska, a political force within the state of Alaska, and recognized across the nation as a group of American people that took a congressional action and made it work.
So when you look at the video, I am so reminded of a young Don Young as looking like John Wayne. Is that my imagination?
Well, he certainly sounded like him. Very plain spoken, And the way he was describing ANCSA, there are elements of it that are a huge success. And he was pointing those out at a time when people were seeing the drawbacks and the flaws much more than they were seeing the successes, because they were looking at taxation on corporate lands and on the ability of shareholders to sell their shares. And so the big fear was that natives would lose control of their Alaska Native corporations and the land would go out of native hands. It would go out of native ownership. So he was emphasizing the other side of that, which was that the corporations brought money into the economy under the control of Alaska Native corporations and made natives an economic power, an economic force in the state, and gave us more clout. And so he was pointing out that side of the act.
Mm-hmm.
So Nellie, are you like me reminded of John Wayne when you hear Don Young and see him?
Actually, you know, until you said that, I hadn't thought of it, but he did sound really good. We've all gotten older, of course, but yeah, definitely Don Young.
That was 1981, so it's a long time ago, and we all looked a lot younger back then. But it's interesting, you know, that we've heard from Don Young and Jay Hammond, who both had Alaska Native wives, who have both since passed on. But do you think that that made a difference in their outlook on ANCSA, the fact that they had married into Native families?
I think so, you know, and they were probably able to see things that many other people weren't able to. Don Young, you know, he taught in Fort Yukon for how long? And, you know, he was, you know, out there visiting or whatever and getting to know people because his wife was from there. And then as far as Jay Hammond, I think he'd been out in the bush quite a bit, you know, and he knew because he flew. And he knew a lot of people and did a lot of things, didn't he, trap? He, I think, had also become familiar with a lot of Native issues, including subsistence, which turned out to be a big ball of fire for everybody.
Yeah, there were a lot of balls of fire burning in the 80s and 90s, from subsistence rights battles to trying to get the land claims put in place.
As far as being married to Native women, I think what that did is it probably, like Nellie said, brought them into contact with a lot of Alaska Natives and probably in village situations. When I think of life in small town Alaska, you end up spending a lot of time sitting around drinking tea. And that's when you can have a really thoughtful, honest exchange of ideas. And I think that in the case of Jay Hammond and Don Young, I think in both their cases, it did give them a lot of insight into what was going on in the Native community and how non-Natives were reacting to things that were happening. And what was happening then is the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act had just been passed. So Alaska Natives had Aboriginal hunting and fishing rights that were extinguished by the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. But in the process of adopting that piece of legislation, Congress said, we'll deal with hunting and fishing rights later. And they did deal with it in ANILCA by saying that subsistence would be a priority need for rural residents in Alaska. So as Nellie said, this turned out to be just a ball of fire. So it didn't say natives have a preference. It said rural residents have a preference. And so some people sued, some urban Alaskans sued, and said that violates the state constitution. And the Alaska Supreme Court in 1989 agreed. And so then everything kind of was thrown up into the air. And we've just been dealing with it ever since. So what we ended up having is a system where the federal government gives a preference to rural residents and the state does not. The state opens subsistence up pretty much for everyone, urban or rural.
And that's because based on apparently a clause in the Constitution that provides equal ownership of the resources. So the backdrop of the 1980s was just so full of uncertainty and problems. And you could sense from Frank Berry's highlights reel that there's a lot of frustration about how non-natives were regarding ANCSA. And I want to play this Spud Williams excerpt. It's pretty spicy. But you want to set this up a little bit, Nellie, and tell us about Spud Williams?
Didn't he work for Tamanaw Chiefs? Anyway, he worked out of Fairbanks most of the time. And he was a very colorful speaker. He didn't usually hold back. He just got right down to the bottom of it. And a lot of people weren't used to that. But at the same time, I think he jarred people and they think about it more.
All right. Well, let's listen to Spud express his frustrations about how the state and most of the mainstream media regarded ANCSA and the settlement.
There are people in this state who say that the Land Claims Act was much more than a settlement of the debt that was owed to us for the land that was stolen. I get tired of hearing the newspaper articles from the other side say, we gave the Alaska Native 44 million acres and $1 billion. They didn't give us shit.
So Spud says, I get tired of you saying that we gave you land. You didn't give us shit. So anyway, so we hear that. So Jocelyn, what do you think about that comment? He put it out there, didn't he?
Well, he's absolutely right in the sense that because we had Aboriginal title to the land, we did own Alaska. And non-natives have a really hard time accepting that as a basic matter of fact. I hear this kind of discussion a lot in just various settings, and I have a hard time explaining that nobody questions the right of people who inherited land and whose family has owned land for the past 300 years in Ireland or England or some other European country. But when it comes to the United States, people don't recognize Aboriginal title. Alaska has 393 million acres of land. Alaska Natives ended up with clear title. We were not given land. We were given title to the land we already owned. And we were given clear title to 44 million acres. In exchange, we gave clear title to all the people of Alaska and the United States to the rest of Alaska. So that's 300 and some million acres that came to the state of Alaska, to the Native corporations, and to the federal government with clear title. And that was the contribution of Alaska Natives.
And nowadays also, most of the corporations, the Native corporations, will allow non-natives to come in and hunt or whatever on their lands as long as they get a permit. And so it's not exactly totally closed to others.
I know. Isn't that interesting? Because I don't think that private lands are open to hunting and fishing generally in other states. But for some reason, Native corporations are expected to let non-natives hunt and fish on corporate lands. And this is a problem, especially in the Otna region, where around Tok and Copper Center, the Richardson and the Glen Highways both intersect there. And so you can drive to that part of the state from Fairbanks and Anchorage. And especially in caribou hunting season, hundreds of hunters and fishermen in the summertime all travel to that part of the state to hunt and fish. And the Native corporations do leave their lands open for that use as long as people get permits.
Yeah, I guess we still see those challenges. And I hate to generalize, but I don't think that the state as a whole truly understands the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And probably if you went out in the middle of the street and stopped 20 people and asked them if they knew what the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was, how many people just in general would know?
When I told people it was the 50th anniversary of ASA, a lot of them just look at me blankly.
And yet this is a piece of legislation that changed the state forever. And after statehood, historians say, is probably the most important piece of legislation since statehood. So it's interesting that Alaskans have no awareness of this. And that's one of the things I think about the Frank Berry video that's featured this week, is that here is an attempt to provide some analysis for people. Now, we don't know if this video was ever shown, because the version that was found is not complete. There's a slate in front of it that says rough cut or first cut. And so apparently it wasn't finished. And so I don't know if this was a version that remained, you know, the original version, the master version that was shown was aired and just lost. You know, there's so many things that we just don't know about it. But I thought it was so interesting that he tried to provide analysis. And the interesting thing too about the Alaska Native Foundation is that they were funded by the Ford Foundation, and they used part of their grant money to buy subscriptions to the Tundra Times newspaper, which was probably for Alaska Natives for a long time the only source of information about the land claims fight, because the mainstream media did not cover it to a great degree.
There was also some difficulty in getting Anchorage papers, because a lot of people in the bush didn't subscribe to them. And sometimes they were harder to get because maybe they were in a pile in the back of a restaurant kitchen. But the Tundra Times was so widely distributed in the bush, that must be how that happened.
To me, this program that Frank Berry produced shows that he was trying to meet a need to get different perspectives. Today, we watch the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention. It's broadcast live, and there isn't a lot of analysis of what happens. I think partly because the mainstream media doesn't truly understand ANCSA, because many people are newcomers to the state, and it's a very complicated subject. It isn't easy to understand. And maybe we should talk about your coverage of the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention at this point, because both of you have done gavel-to-gavel radio coverage of the convention every year. And that's what lasts for about 3 or 4 days. That was really a fairly recent development, where you do provide some analysis of what the speakers have said. So in some ways, I think Frank Berry was ahead of his time. But why is this so important to have this kind of information out there? I mean, this raises the question about sort of mainstream media coverage of Alaska Native issues and the Claims Act. As we talked about before, people draw a blank when you say it's the 50th anniversary of ANCSA.
There are plenty of great reporters in Alaska, and they work in mainstream media, but there aren't enough to cover a lot of subjects in depth. I mean, we don't have the New York Times. Actually, something that comes to mind when I say the New York Times, it reminds me of when Sarah Palin was running to become vice president of the United States. And suddenly we did have the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Seattle Times, you know, Los Angeles Times, all these major national news outlets, Reuters, Associated Press. All those reporters came to Alaska, and reporters here had been covering Sarah Palin for years, but all of a sudden we had people who were digging deep and finding out things that had been overlooked. And that's the kind of thing you can do when you have a lot of reporters and they're experienced and well-trained and have resources. So I think that's one of the reasons why we don't get the mainstream coverage, media coverage of Native issues in Alaska that we'd like to see. And the other thing is that to a certain extent, Alaska is a training ground. This is a place of great opportunity for people. You can be a brand new graduate of college and go to a radio station in rural Alaska, and you're the only news person. That's hard. It's hard to be the only person in a newsroom, but you have free rein. And so you can gain this kind of breadth of experience that in rural Alaska, being a reporter there, that you can't get in a large newsroom somewhere else. If you're in a newsroom with 30 or 40 reporters, pretty quickly you're going to get assigned to a beat, and that's what you're going to cover. And maybe you're working on education, and most of your time will be spent covering the school board and schools and interviewing teachers and kids and parents and that sort of thing. And you're not covering politics. And that does allow people to get into in-depth coverage. So I think that's something that it'd be great if we had it. And something I'm seeing nowadays, I work for Indian Country Today, and it's an example of this, and that is nonprofits that raise money sort of on the public radio and public television model, but also from grants to hire reporters and operate news operations. Because we lost all the advertising to the internet. We've seen newsrooms all over the country just get decimated, cut from 20 people to 3 and stuff like that.
So the two of you have been very instrumental in your careers in trying to help people understand the big issues of the day, starting with your gavel-to-gavel coverage, live radio broadcasts of the AFN convention. And so I hope maybe the two of you would talk a little bit about that. Was it difficult to do?
It was difficult to do, you know, every time we've ever done it, including radio and gavel-to-gavel. We've had to bring in reporters. So we'd bring people in from Bethel, Barrow, Dillingham. So we had enough for a pretty good sized crew so they could cover smaller meetings and make sure that we knew about what was really happening out there. So getting all of those logistics. And in the beginning, we paid their transportation and housing and everything. And then we had to make sure we had all the equipment.
But basically, covering Native issues was a do-it-yourself proposition for Alaska Natives.
Well, things were very different when I was doing gavel-to-gavel coverage. Nellie, you started doing that probably in the late 80s, maybe, and into the 90s. I remember I assisted one year that you were doing it. I was one of the people who ran around with the microphone on the floor of the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention and got people for you to interview. I was a runner, basically. By the time I was doing it, it was in the early 2000s, and my employer, Kiwanis Broadcasting, didn't have the funding to bring people in from rural stations. And so occasionally, Bethel might send a reporter. By then, KBRW and Barrow or Utqiagvik no longer had a news department, so they weren't sending reporters. But we would get reporters from the Alaska Public Radio Network, or what's now known as Alaska Public Media. And some years we would have somebody from Juneau, from KTOO in Juneau, who would come. And those reporters were working on their own stories for their audience and for their station. But I could use materials they were generating for the newscast that we put on at the station where I worked, KNBA.
And I might add, this is how difficult it was. The first year we did coverage of AFN, we won the highest award the press club was giving out, was a public service award. They didn't even know who we were. And we didn't even find out till much later. We did it again with another AFN. So, you know, you don't get one of those awards without doing something extraordinary to get to where you're going.
And yet the press club didn't know who you were. Mm-mm. And what you were doing. Of course, these entries are judged by outside organizations in the lower 48, other news organizations. That's really an interesting insight that within our own state, in our own media, that we have had for a long time blind spots. I mean, I think some of it's gotten better, but one of the things that we see now is that Alaska Natives kind of do their own media. Jacqueline, you're a correspondent for Indian Country Today. So even though you're based here in Alaska, and there's been a lot of good coverage of ANCSA and Indian Country Today, a national magazine, maybe more than you've seen in our own local publications.
Oh, absolutely. We have Megan Sullivan, who's just doing a top-notch job as a special correspondent for Indian Country Today on ANCSA at 50. I just admire what she's doing so much, because not only is she doing great reporting, but she's doing a lot of it. She's been working on it for months and months, and now the stories are starting to come out. I mean, she's been publishing it, I think, for 3 or 4 months now, really regularly. And then there's Alice Glenn, who has a podcast called Coffee and Quack. But I also have to give a shout out to the Anchorage Daily News for their coverage of missing and murdered Native women. KNOM, actually, out of Nome, did a series of stories on missing and murdered Indigenous women. And those have been very powerful. Well, the Anchorage Daily News got a Pulitzer Prize for its coverage of that topic. So it takes a special effort, but it can be done. And sometimes mainstream media does step up.
Before we go, we should talk about the Alaska Native Media Group. You're both members of that organization, and their main mission is to recruit Alaska Natives into journalism and the communication fields. And the driving force in that group is a woman named Irene Rowan. And Nellie, you've worked with her a lot over the years, putting together panels on ANCSA. Can you tell us a little bit about Irene?
I've come to know Irene Rowan pretty well. Usually when she calls me, she wants to do some big project. Irene Rowan was in Washington, D.C. about the time when they were going over ANCSA. And she worked in the legislative halls. She worked for people in the Interior Department. So she had a huge insight knowledge of what was going on in Washington. And so she was like, we need more coverage of Native issues. And she called me up and said that. And then she said, you know, we need to celebrate the anniversaries of ANCSA. I was like, okay, what do you want to do? We started the group. And then after, you know, how Natives are, we argued over the title for a long time, and then we finally did it. And so I am just so impressed with the people who have joined up. At the beginning, we only had a few people coming in, and then it turned into a pretty good group. I hope it continues to grow and do a lot of coverage, because there aren't many Native reporters on the air now. There's some that are in the background, but there aren't really any people who are on the air who are Native in Anchorage.
Yeah, the two of you have kind of been pioneers in Native broadcasters. So tell us, Jacqueline, since you're also Tlingit, like Irene Rowan is, tell us about Irene Rowan. She's an amazing elder who has more energy than most young people.
Well, she is from Haines, and her mother was Mildred Sparks, who was a grand president of the Alaska Native Sisterhood. And that's an organization that it uses Robert's Rules of Order, and they have an annual convention where they adopt resolutions on political subjects, basically. They're a lot like the Alaska Federation of Natives in that sense. They're an advocacy organization. And her mother was a leader in the Alaska Native Sisterhood. So Irene went to college, and then she worked in the Department of Interior. She worked on the campaign, the political campaign of U.S. Senator Mike Gravel. She later became an educator. She taught in Bethel for several years, and then she taught at University of Alaska Anchorage. With Alaska Native Media Group, I think one of the biggest accomplishments was when she and Nellie teamed up with John Butsky to produce a series of panel discussions on the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. So there have been shows like, and Nellie, you can tell us more, but there was ANCSA at 20 years and ANCSA at the 30-year anniversary, the 40-year anniversary, women in ANCSA. What were some of the other topics?
We also interviewed Don Young, Mike Gravel. Yeah, it was a lot of the current hot topics and hot topics that could be discussed from years past, because she knew about it. So she's been a big fountain of information for me.
I think it's really interesting. Every Thursday night on KTOO 360 TV, we're airing a program of some kind that relates to ANCSA. And many of those were programs that Irene Rowan was the force behind, teaming up with you, Nelly, to do the interviews. To me, I think it's really interesting that she recognized a need for a Native perspective, because the two of you would ask questions that are totally different than maybe a non-Native reporter would think to ask.
Yep, and we had a lot of fun, you know, getting ready for each program. She would call me up and say, have you covered this part of it or that part of it? She gave me good reminders of what I needed to be sure and cover. She's been a good teacher for me.
A teacher for me, because I don't know a lot of things about ANCSA. And so I frequently call her and say, well, what about this? And my God, the woman is a veritable encyclopedia. I think we'll call her Rowanopedia when it comes to things ANCSA. But she likes to stay behind the scenes. So there's probably no way I could drag her kicking and screaming into doing a program with us to talk about it. But she has been a driving force in the Alaska Native Media Group, which has been behind getting this marathon of ANCSA-related programming on the air. And just in closing, you know, what do you think we can do as a media to help people understand ANCSA better? Because truly, whether people know it or not in our state, they're affected by ANCSA. Native corporations pay property taxes across Anchorage. They provide scholarships for students. They're helping to develop our labor pool. There's so much that Native corporations do. And there's also things about Native corporations that we should be concerned about. So it's not all a perfect world, but it seems to me that we do have a gap in mainstream media of covering ANCSA corporations.
Well, if there's a time to be paying attention, this is it. December 18th is the 50-year anniversary of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And so, I mean, the Anchorage Press, the Anchorage Daily News, the television stations, public radio, commercial television, and authors of all kinds are producing content. You'll be seeing magazine articles, articles on digital platforms, and hearing radio and seeing television stories about it. And plus these shows that are being broadcast on KTOO every Thursday.
So at this 50th anniversary juncture, we've talked about a lot of things, and ANCSA is just so complicated. You know, there are so many moving parts to this legislation and its impact. But any final thoughts on what we should be thinking about at this anniversary?
I think one thing I hope is that young people and adults are proud of being Alaska Native. Some people get put down a lot and they have a low opinion of being Native, but it's a very good life if you take advantage of some of its benefits, you know, like getting dried white fish from Militech. I think the discrimination that has gone on for many years has been difficult to fight. And so that's another thing that I hope we can work on more.
Well, I would second that. That's for sure. I think that the world is a beautiful and complex place, and the Native community is a beautiful and complex kind of world of its own. We can take a lot of pride in the fact that we're still here.
And we're always happy when Jacqueline Estes and Nellie Moore are here with us. Jocelyn is a national correspondent for Indian Country Today, and Nellie cut her teeth reporting in Kotzebue and went on to become a host of National Native News. She's also hosted many of the programs that you've been watching on our KTOO 360 TV series, Angst 50, The Journey Continues, which airs on Thursday nights at 8. And on Saturday, December 18th, there will be an all-day marathon of programs. Each program in the series will be rebroadcast and cover a span of more than 50 years. So you will really get to see the baby that was born on December 18th, 1971, grow up. Up next, Congressman Don Young weighs in on the Claims Act, and a little known fact, he is actually a shareholder in a Native corporation. I'll ask him about that when we come back. Listening to the companion broadcast for KTOO 360 TV's Angst 50, The Journey Continues, a weekly series leading up to the 50th anniversary of the Claims Act on December 18th. Earlier in the show, you heard Congressman Don Young address the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention in 1981 at the 10-year anniversary. At that time, he expressed surprise that the Claims Act had worked at all. That was 40 years ago, and recently I asked him about the source of his skepticism.
Sort of a long history, Ron, that some people don't remember the history of where it started. It really started when there was a lawsuit filed against the building of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline by Stevens Village, and Wally Hickel was governor at that time, and he proposed a land settlement with the Alaska Natives. It wasn't popular, but the seed had been planted. And then, of course, as the embargo increased on oil, there was a greater demand for building that Trans-Alaskan pipeline. I introduced the Trans-Alaskan pipeline, but along that, in the same idea, was Ted Stevens. Ted was the main one. We were able to convey the thought of a new idea about Aboriginal people and the utilization of their land, not the refuge system, but the concept of what we call regional corporations, and not villages, and not tribes. And that was part of it. But Ted's idea was to have a different system, make it better, and he was right. Most of our reservations, the lower 48, are a disaster, have been for years and years and years and years. And so he wanted to give them a better opportunity with 44 million acres and $1 billion, which happened in 1971. And of course, if you realize 1972, after I was elected, the first bill I introduced was the Trans-Alaskan Pipeline. We had big support for it because they had an embargo, and we got that done. They're all sort of tied together.
So one thing that a lot of people don't know is that you actually own shares in a Native corporation. And I can't imagine that anyone else in Congress owns shares in a Native corporation. How did that happen?
Now, as far as the shareholders go, it was very simple. I had a dear friend named Elijah John, who was a friend of my wife's father, senior citizen, and people sort of forgot him. And I used to go up there every time I'd go hunting. If I get something, I'd take him something. If I went fishing, I'd take him some fish, because I listened to these. He had great stories about the old days and things, how they were, and that I learned a lot. And the ironic part about it, when he passed away, he says, "To my good friend, my friend Don Young, I bequeath my Doyon shares to Mr. Young." And I thought that was one of the nicest gestures I've ever seen. I can't vote, of course. I had nothing to do with that, but it was just a gesture of, I call, mutual respect for one another. And I get a little tear in my eye when I think about it. It was just a good thing. I mean, I just loved him, and he reciprocated that by letting me have the shares.
You said it was a very touching gift. How has that sort of resonated with you over the years?
Well, you know, when I say it was a touching, you know, a lot of people forget their senior citizens. They don't talk to them. That one of the biggest problems, senior citizens being lonesome. I'm fortunate. I have a great wife. I have an active staff. I have people I communicate with. I have the constituency. But the average senior citizen's biggest problem is being lonesome. And I made up for it. I did it selfishly because I wanted to hear his stories. I mean, not many people know the stories of Vinnie Taitlani. Nobody knows that you're listening to this program that was there. Or the creation of Vinnie Tai Reservation, which is not a reservation, it was a land use reservation under Wickersham. They don't know the history of everything. And I'm a very big buff on history. You know, I never did it to think there would be any gain out of it. The gain was the love of a man that would have been forgotten.
So back to the subject of ANCSA. Do you think that legislation that passed 50 years ago would be possible today?
No. And by the way, I had not become a congressman. It happened in 1971. I became a congressman in 1972. And that was Ted Stevens and frankly, Nick Begich were on that program. And Ted had this vision of a different system. My job after I got elected was to implement the act itself. And it was a big job. I mean, you think what was required, we had to set up corporations. How many Native people at that time knew anything about a corporation? There was no tribes, as I mentioned before. There was just this corporation. They had to have profit and nonprofit. They had to enroll. And I'm being a little cynical now, but my past wife used to say, where were they before the Land Claims Act? There was a whole lot more Natives after the Land Claims Act than it was before, because there was $1 billion involved in 44 million acres. But we had to enroll every one of those, and they were enrolled, and they created the corporations across the state, and then, of course, one in Seattle. So it was an act, my biggest involvement, really, I call legislative next step, was 1991 Land Claims Act.
So, Congressman Young, you came in after the act was passed, and so it's sort of like the second big chapter in this ongoing saga. Why do you think that it would be impossible to do something like this today?
Well, there's really two reasons. One is the federal government itself. One of the big battles I've had implementing the act is fighting with the federal government, Park Service, Forest Service, not BLM so much, but somewhat, and Fish and Wildlife. They believe it's their land. And I argued, no, it's not their land. 44 million acres of those lands belong to the Native people of Alaska. But they're reluctant to convey it. And I've got this Native land allotment for Vietnam veterans. I've been past that three times, got to sign a law. I'm finally getting close to it, and then this administration backed off of it. These are the right things to do. When Congress passes a law, the agencies should implement it. I have cases where now some of the regional corporations want to develop their land, and they're being told by other federal agencies they can't do it, or if they do it, they have to mitigate their land. And it's not in the act itself. I got a local case in the Yukon Flats where Birch Creek wants to drill for oil. It's their land. It's their people. And then the Fish and Wildlife come in and say, it's not compatible with the refuge. Well, they were there before, not only historically, but they were there on the act of Congress. So they ought to be able to do what they want to without another agency say they can't. That's sort of like giveth and taketh. And I say it's wrong, and I'm fighting this battle all the time against other agencies. That's the number one thing. And of course, you see that in the Tongass National Forest, trying to get land down there, the Native villages down in seven of them down there in Southeast Alaska. And they're all upset. They don't want to do it. So I'm just saying that's the biggest battle we have now is against the government would not happen. And that disturbs me because the government never has managed their land correctly. Actually, they mismanage it. And the Forest Service is a classic example of that nationwide and, of course, in Alaska.
So what was the second reason?
The second one is makeup of the Congress now is very much changed. We have about 95% of the Congress come from large cities, and they've been told that it's their land and it wouldn't be the Natives' land. So it would never get in. We'd never get it out of committee. I could even try it in the committee when we were in charge. And we didn't get anywhere. So it's a different attitude, different concept right now. And that's why I think it was the best piece of legislation ever passed for Aboriginal people. And I'm proud of the fact that it has happened.
I guess you can never foresee the future. What is that saying about seeing through the glass darkly? What things did you not foresee happening with this legislation?
Well, first, I really didn't think it would succeed. I'm proud of the fact I helped to succeed. You think about going in and saying, okay, at that time, I think we had about, I don't know, maybe it's a little less than 100,000 Alaska Natives. And they had to set up corporations. They had to set up profit, nonprofit. They had to set up village corporations. They had to enroll all their people. This thing was a nightmare. But by golly, they rose to the occasion and they created, I think, one of the better economic units in the state of Alaska. And through this act itself, the one thing I did object to, 5 million acres, thank God they turned that down and we ended up with 44 and $1 billion. If I'd had my way, and I wasn't in the Congress at that time, it had been 100 million acres and no money, because money had a way of dissipating itself very quickly, because all the, I call the vultures, were hanging around to get a part of it. But out of that, though, after all that time, they ended up with, you know, some very strong corporations within the state. We did play a role in making sure some of them survived with 8A contracting, which has been a great success. It just keeps going on and on. And they have an opportunity now to be the largest contributor economically to the state of Alaska. That was never expected, nor would it ever happen if it was under the old system of reservations.
Was there a certain kind of cynicism out there about where this would go?
I believe there's great cynicism. And remember, they did it primarily to get the Trans-Alaskan pipeline built because of the lawsuit. Now, I think the cynicism was actually based upon how it was written and as best could do at the time. But there were a lot of people wanting it to fail. It didn't fail.
What were some of the biggest surprises for you out of ANCSA, how it evolved?
You know, if any big surprises, did it work? The fact is they could put it together. That helped me in the sense that I wanted it to work, because I do believe it's the greatest contributor to the state of Alaska economically and socially of any bills ever passed the state of Alaska, including the state of it. So remember, 44 million acres bigger than the state of Oregon. And we don't have Portland, thank God for that. But it didn't surprise me, but in a way I was pleasantly pleased.
Come back, more of my conversation with Congressman Don Young about what happened after the birth of the Claims Act, the job of helping it grow up and mature. Are listening to the companion podcast for the KTOO 360 TV series, ANCSA at 50, The Journey Continues. Now, in our last segment, Congressman Don Young talked about the legislation's successes, but I also asked him about the challenges. One of the biggest disappointments for Alaska Natives in ANCSA is the impact on subsistence, that they didn't quite feel that they got the control of the land that they understood that they would have.
Well, I dispute that in the sense that the reason they don't is federal government. The word subsistence never existed until we passed the National Lands Act. It occurred, it happened, but it was never there. It was never a word. And now it's a word. And I understand their frustration. I argue that they ought to be controlling fish and game on federal lands. Now, the state has control of it to some degree, mostly federal government. And the federal government runs it. The Bering Strait deal up there, I think they ought to be handling that park up there. Why should we bring people from outside to manage park lands when we got people there? You know, I've never understood that. And I had my park service say, well, they're not qualified. We're not qualified for what? Filling out a form? I have never understood that argument. So that's one of the big fights I've still got going. I want to, and maybe giving a little more autonomy to the ANCs to manage areas of land. The conflict comes from very frankly, from between the state. Now, I argue the state itself should manage land on federal lands. The native groups should manage land on their lands. Now, that's a very unpopular thing to say, but it is their land. And this goes back to privacy.
You came in basically after ANCSA was born.
It was still wet.
And so the next step was raising the child, so to speak. And you, of any legislator, have been with this now since the death of Ted Stevens and the others that birthed this legislation. You've seen it through the longest of anybody, I think. I don't think there's anybody left Congress.
Remember, I'm the longest serving congressman in Congress, so there's nobody seen it like I have seen it. No, I was very proud of that act itself. I did a lot of work on it prior to the congressional. It didn't start in Congress. It started in the state, in Wally Hickel. There was a proposal to give natives a certain amount of land. Remember, to build a pipeline. It sort of got shot down. It wasn't very popular, but that seed was planted, and Ted picked it up when we were in the Congress to get the pipeline built, because we had a lawsuit in Stevens Village. I go back to sort of repetitive itself, but, you know, an embargo at that time, gasoline was 39 cents a gallon, but you couldn't get any gas. So that helped us out to build a pipeline, but you couldn't build a pipeline until you settled the Alaska Native Land Claims Act.
What were the lessons that should be learned from this? I mean, what did you learn through this process, and what do we need to think about now on this 50th anniversary?
It's just like the baby. You have the baby, you have to grow it. You have to raise it. You have to discipline it. You have to ward it. You have to love it. You have to hold it. You have to do everything as it gets older, and as it gets in, hopefully you did a good enough job, it gets into maturity that you can keep nurturing it until it goes on and on and on and doesn't die, but it will, but it'll be transferred to other people and really fully implement, I think, one of the greatest pieces of legislation we've ever passed the Congress. That's my goal. I've been working with them. By the way, these aren't my ideas. These ideas come from the leaders of the Native community. And they come to me and say, can you help me do this? And if you go back to the history, I had more land. I had to do legislatively because the agencies wouldn't help, transfer to the Native corporations through legislation, because that was the intent of the act. I've been doing this all across the state because I do believe in economic for the state and for the benefit of the social background of the Native people.
Well, one of the criticisms over the years, and I think that Native corporations have addressed it, but that the corporations were somehow robbing the people of their traditional cultures.
You have to understand, people that say that aren't living the culture themselves. It always bothered me when they say they're losing my culture, and you're driving around in a $40,000 boat with an outboard and with a Magnum rifle and a down sleeping bag, and the corporations are taking this culture away from. Don't do that. That is what you call someone's got sour grapes. And let's say, okay, if there is a problem, work within the Native corporation themselves. Say, we don't believe this is correct. Don't start going to the press and say, this is what's happened. We're losing it. Usually that's instigated by some white guy, by the way.
Alaska has birthed a lot of great ideas from the permanent fund dividend program. The world regards some of these ideas as great ideas, but I wonder, do you think that there are some applications to the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act to other problems around the world?
Well, I'm one of these people, and it sounds like I'm one of my, never mind. I don't believe government solves the problem. I don't believe they should tell you how and when to do things. I'm a libertarian when it comes to that. And I think ownership of land gives you the right of vision and a right to develop and right to improve your existing being. And I believe that's, very frankly, the greatest thing that's ever happened to the Anska. When those object to it, there's few still, well, it didn't work. You know, what didn't work? What if we would have saved our culture? Okay. Where would they have been if they had the last Native Land Claims Act? They'd been nowhere. They still wouldn't be able to walk into a bar. There'd be signs against it. I can go on down the line. The improvement by giving the basis for an economic well-being is improved overall, all the Native culture within the state of Alaska. Do you want to go back? I talked to Willie Hensley about this. You know, this idea, we live like the good old days. My wife's grandfather, past wife, not my live wife, past wife's grandfather, we used to sit in meetings. This guy has never gone to school, read the Bible well, and they'd have these meetings, and the guys would get up and talk about, usually somebody, never mind, would say, we got to go back to the good old days. And he'd turn to me and say, Don, they don't know what they're talking about. We had no medicine. We starved to death. There was no benefits to anything. And sure, you lived off the land, but it was not the way they can live today. Times have changed, and they have to recognize that. So I really think out of this is going to be a real legacy. Now, will it ever happen again? I doubt it, Ron. I really do. I don't think it'll happen because the federal government will not allow us to have access to land because they say it belongs to all the people. Well, to me, that's being very short-sighted and not good for the freedoms of individuals.
I think that in some ways that the Native Claims Settlement Act has been just as good, if not even more beneficial for Alaska's non-native population. Absolutely. I mean, the person that has the retail job in Costco has it because there are dividends that the native community has to spend.
All together. You can't separate us apart. And it's the largest economic factor in the state of Alaska. Now, I think it exceeds oil as far as total economic growth. And that's good for the state of Alaska. We're all Alaskans. And to me, to say, well, this is not, I didn't get my fair share. There's no such thing as a fair share. There is a share. It may be smaller than the other guys, but it's a share. And that always comes from this type of legislation. And there's a lot of people say, well, if so-and-so's getting rich. Well, maybe he is, maybe he isn't. I don't know. But I do know this. They have a way to solve that problem by not letting them be in office, for instance. So, you know, I think it's just a good program, works well, has worked well, and will work well. As I said, like we're growing the child. We've done this to the point now they're adults, and they're going to go forth, and I think they'll contribute a great deal to the state of Alaska for many, many years to come.
You know, you kind of contradict yourself in some ways when you say that government is the problem, but yet government is kind of what helped create ANCSA along with...
No. You got it. The government is not the executive branch. That is what causes the problems today. Park Service, Fish and Wildlife, BLM, you name it. EPA, the rest of it. I'm talking about the people. That's the difference. That's the government I'm talking about, and they've done a good job. I just argue the government does too much, and they overreaches all the time. And it's not their... They say that we allow it in Congress. One of the reasons we allow it in Congress is there's only about 5% of us come from rural areas. The rest of them come from big cities that know the front side and back side of a barn.
So in your view, is there any unfinished business for ANCSA that needs to be done?
Well, if I had my way, I'd make sure that like my veterans bill would be implemented. I'd make sure every acre of land that they are supposed to get is gotten. And then we take a look at down the road at what they think should be done to improve it. I can't give you an outright suggestion now because, you know, again, I'm very frankly, they're in charge and I'm happy for them. They will come to me. I talk to a lot of them. I'm trying to get some ports built in certain parts of the state that belong to natives. I'm trying to make sure that they've come to me. And every time they come to me, you'll find out that I've been very responsive because that's my job, but it's good for the state as a whole, just not the Alaska Native corporations.
Can you talk a little bit about the tweaks to ANCSA and how they're part of an evolution?
Yes, any type of major legislation that's new is going to have some tweaks. The tweaks came from the people that asked me to tweak it.
I think that up until the 1991 amendments, there was this fear that Alaska Natives would sell their land, sell their stocks, and all the resources that they received at the beginning of ANCSA would just simply dissipate into the general economy, and they would again be dispossessed.
Well, yeah, that's what it was, a fear, and it was a fear of the Natives. As any other corporation, you have a board, and boards change. I don't think there wouldn't be people internationally and nationally wouldn't be interested in gobbling up, you know, a couple million acres. But it would have destroyed the basis of the economic well-being of the original act itself.
Did that impress you that they took that step and asked you to help with that?
I liked it, let's put it that way, because I thought it was right, too. I'm a big believer as an old farm boy that land is the most valuable thing God ever created, and you don't get rid of it willy-nilly. And that's what it would have happened. But now we solve that problem, don't have to worry about it anymore.
One of the things that's out there on the horizon is ANCSA's 7i clause, its profit-sharing mechanism, which allowed the profits to be spread across the different corporations, sort of a one-for-all and all-for-one sort of approach. And it did help a lot of the corporations that struggled stay afloat. And now it looks like some corporations who have the potential to earn a lot of money want to revisit that structure. What do you think about that? Do you think that's a good idea? Because it seems to have lifted all boats in some ways over the years. Do we want to mess with a good thing?
That's something that's within the group. I'm trying to tell them not to fight about this, not to argue. Set it down and work it out. There may be a way we can improve upon it. Really, it was the only money that kept a lot of the corporations going for a long time because they had no resources. That's one of the problems that many people don't recognize. Some of the corporation didn't have the resources. Now they've done better because of 8A contracting, et cetera. But the idea was to balance it out better over the 44 million acres to let the, what we call the, actually it was sort of a socialist program, but everybody got a share of the resources that were natural. Now, like I say, some people don't like that. I worry, and I've told them, think about it before you come with a proposal, because this is still a hot issue in Congress by those that don't believe in the Aboriginal people, that they would probably end up like 8A contractors under constant attack. It's awful, a bunch of natives getting all these contracts. Well, they've done a good job. And I have not had one federal agency complain about the work being done. But people don't like it, you know, because it's a special group. It's all right to do it in Watts in L.A., but not good up there. So you have to protect it. If you open these things up, sometimes you create a bigger problem than what you think you have. Anyway, this issue is something I love, and you know, it's great for Alaska. And when I secede from the Union, become emperor, to come talk to me too.
Oh.
Big announcement right now, emperor.
Congressman Don Young, marking the 50th anniversary of ANCSA. I'm Rhonda McBride, and thank you for joining me for ANCSA at 50, The Journey Continues, a collaboration of KTOO, the Alaska Native Media Group, and the Alaska Moving Image Preservation Association. Hope this program has given you insight into a story that remains a work in progress.